about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
This is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. Thank you to everyone who called in during our fall membership drive. With your amazing support, we reached our $80,000 goal. We would also like to thank all of our volunteers for doing a great job and for making KBOO a great community and radio station. And thank you to all of the restaurants that provided food. For more information on them, visit kboo.fm/food. We are proud to be your radio station and honored to have your support this fall membership drive. Thank you.
The time is now 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lentz International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday through October at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lentz Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for Kids, a community table, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More at lentzfarmersmarket.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Department of Education releases new rules on sexual assault on college campuses.
The Palestinian Liberation Organization works toward recognition at the UN.
And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales questions a judge's authority to require annual court hearings on police reforms.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 17th, 2014. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales apparently doesn't like annual performance reviews. But then who does? U.S. District Judge Michael H. Simon recently ordered the City of Portland to appear before his court for annual reviews on the city's promised police reforms to be sure those reforms are being carried out in accordance with the settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice. But city attorneys this year spent months challenging Simon's desire to have all the parties to the case appear before him at least once a year to provide updates on the reforms in open court. The city's reluctance to accept the annual reviews in court has baffled federal prosecutors and community members. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Dennis Thorault for more on the issue.
Could you give us some background on the police reforms and how they came about?
The reason the federal Justice Department came to Portland, we had had some shootings and other uses of force against people, in some cases African-American, in all cases struggling with mental illness. And the Justice Department opened an investigation at the behest of former Mayor Sam Adams and City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, and found, in fact, that our officers had engaged in a pattern or practice of using excessive force in defiance of the Constitution against people with mental illness or who had been perceived to have mental illness. We technically never agreed with that finding, but we did agree to come up with a series of reforms and settle that case that the Justice Department filed against us. And those reforms deal with changes in training, changes in how we use force, limits on taser use, pricing de-escalation, things like that.
Judge Michael Simon requires the city to report some kind of results to him every now and again. Do you mind explaining that?
When the judge in August, finally, after almost 2 years, said, okay, I think this is a fair, reasonable, equitable deal, let's go for this, a lot of back and forth with the police union, community groups, trying to get some changes to the reforms. Finally, it's going forward. The police bureau has been working on this, but Judge Simon says, you need to come back every year into my courtroom and tell me how it's going. He can't do anything. He can't compel any changes. He can't modify the agreement, but he thinks he can at least have a public forum. The city doesn't like that. They think that that opens the door to another layer of oversight that isn't included in the settlement. And the Justice Department and community groups don't agree with that. They've sort of separated themselves from the city on this matter. The judge said, you know, I'm going to do this whether you like it or not. And the city now, almost a couple of months after he's done this, has said, let's file an appeal of that piece of it. We're going to still do everything that we have to do in terms of changing the way we operate. They're not going to stop any of that stuff. They're not seeking a stay. And they've couched it as seeking clarification. They want to clarify how those hearings will work. And I think they just want to have the judge on the record saying, I can't make you do anything that you haven't already agreed to.
Why do you think they care so much about this one seemingly rather small part of the settlement?
If they're not doing a good job in enforcing this, and an independent monitor that they're going to hire tells the judge that they're not doing a great job, if the community groups say they're not doing a good job, the judge may ask some pointed questions that they may not rather answer in a public forum like a courtroom. It could be they're worried about embarrassment. It's curious, though, because they talk about how good a job they've been doing when it comes to getting these reforms in place. They've started doing things years before the judge approved this. I mean, it was, you know, 2012. They're starting to change some of their procedures, work on rewriting directives. I mean, they haven't really dragged their feet on some of these things. So it's curious, and I don't know if they're worried about having someone call them into question and it's going to be embarrassing, or if they really just want to make sure that they're not opening a back door to further revisions, changes, etc. They just want to make sure they have an ironclad document that they don't have to worry about the ground shifting beneath.
Where are the enforcement mechanisms here?
We're still waiting for that. We're going to have a compliance officer, community liaison. Maybe they're supposed to be hired by the end of November, 3 months after the judge signed off on the agreement. That was August 29th, so November 29th, this person has to be hired. They've got three finalists, and I guess we'll see something maybe at the end of this month naming that person. They want to move along, because that person then has to hire a board, a community advisory board, and that person is going to be in charge of actually reviewing things, documents, numbers. And that person will be doing some of the reporting to the judge. So that's we're missing that. We've been missing that. And so all we've gotten about compliance so far has come from the police bureau itself. We haven't had that person outside the bureau looking in with full court-compelled access to documents and reports telling us whether they're actually doing everything they said they're doing in the way they're supposed to be doing it.
But they are going along with the reforms themselves, right? There's no appeal on that.
That's right. Anything that they have agreed to do and anything that the judge has told them to do in terms of de-escalating situations, training cops differently, creating more review boards, oversight, all of that, that still has to happen and still has to work. I mean, that's the other thing. They can check it off on the list, but then they actually have to make it work in practice on the street. And we'll begin to sort of be able to see that in the next few months. I mean, that's going to be interesting. And that's one of the reasons I think it's actually really important. And I think a lot of people do that the judge does bring everyone together to have this kind of discussion. It's a great check-in. And if there are issues, the judge can't make anyone do anything differently, but community pressure does have a way of changing things. And if the community is outraged, if other people are outraged, we can make sure that they're on track. And the Justice Department can sue them again, I suppose, if they're not doing what they're supposed to do. Again, I think they will, but the importance of having a hearing is making sure that everyone trusts that.
I've been speaking with Dennis Thorault from the Portland Mercury. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
Mazen Malik, a senior economist with the state of Oregon, was asked by the state to crunch the data to estimate how much tax money legal pot sales would bring in. Here's how the numbers came out. Oregon would raise $9.4 million in the first year, but by the second year, the revenue to the state would go up to $20 million annually. Initially, Malik thinks the price would be high and suppress demand, which helps explain why the revenue number is lower initially. But as kinks got worked out and new users, tourism, and other factors kick in, prices would start to go down and the market for pot would grow. Malik thinks the black market would persist for a while, but eventually the dealers would be flushed out by the legal pot. It might take 10 years or more for issues related to banking, insurance, and other commercial wrinkles of pot legalization to be fully ironed out, he says. This would seem to augur well for the continued growth in legal pot revenue to the state over the long term.
Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has spent $1.25 million to help move an Oregon ballot measure to victory. Measure 90, also known as the Top 2 initiative, would make it possible for all registered voters to vote in the May primary election regardless of party affiliation. After running in the May primary, the two candidates from across the political spectrum will be the final contenders for the partisan offices in the November general elections. The $1.25 million gift brings the Measure 90 campaign coffers to almost $3 million.
In Philadelphia, teachers en masse are protesting the city's unanimous decision to terminate their labor contract. At 4 p.m. Eastern Time, a rally organized by the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers will take place at the headquarters for the School Reform Commission. The mayor and the governor, Tom Corbett, appointed members of this five-person School Reform Commission since the school board was eliminated in 2001. Union leaders will wait till after the November 4th gubernatorial election results come in. Governor Corbett is said to have applauded the move. They claim they won't cut pay for 15,000 teachers, counselors, nurses, and secretaries, but the Teachers' Health and Welfare Fund no longer will be administered by their union. Tweets of solidarity can be seen at #SolidarityWithTeachers.
Today, the U.S. Department of Education announced new rules regarding the reporting of incidents of sexual assault on college campuses. The changes fall under the Cleary Act, named after Jean Cleary, a 19-year-old student who was raped and murdered in her dorm at Lehigh University in 1990. Under the current law, universities must disclose crimes on campus, public property near campus, or other property owned by the school. Now colleges will have to include additional types of crimes, such as stalking, dating and domestic violence, and sexual assault in their annual crime reports. New rules will add gender identity and national origins as categories to include in the data. They will also require colleges to provide information to students on support programs and disciplinary actions. If colleges do not comply, they will risk losing access to federal funds for financial aid. Changes will go into effect July 1, 2015.
A United Nations panel is headed to Detroit this weekend to determine if the city's water shutoffs violate international human rights standards. The UN visitors will assess water, specifically the Detroit Water and Sewage Department's decision to turn off the taps for those residents who don't pay their bills. The Detroit Water Brigade says that the fact that people are without water in the richest country on earth is a human rights violation. The Water Brigade is an organization that focuses on direct assistance, delivering bottled water to those whose service has been shut off, and political advocacy, demanding changes that include tiered, affordable billing. The situation in Detroit, where more than 80,000 people are unable to pay their water bills, has spotlighted an essential question for cities worldwide. Is access to potable drinking water a human right, or does providing water and sewage simply fall under the category of basic municipal services delivered in exchange for fees and taxes? The UN visit was prompted by the July protests in Detroit against the water shutoffs. Motor City is not alone in protesting over water. More than 50,000 protesters took to the streets in Dublin last week, carrying placards denouncing what they call the Ministry of Thirst. They criticized a plan to levy fees for water service. Ireland is currently the only country among so-called developed countries that does not charge citizens for water usage. But that'll change in January 2015 with the implementation of meters and fees.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is showers with a high of 72. Sunday we'll see slightly sunnier skies, partly cloudy, with a high of 70. The quote for the day comes from author David Foster. Let me restate that, from author David Foster Wallace, who said, "The truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you."
It's 5:15. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Okay, that's it. No more Mr. Nice Guy for me. The avarice of corporate power has now turned personal. It's about beer, the nourishing nectar of a civilized society. Since my teen years, I've done extensive and intensive consumer research on the brewer's art, from the full array of ales to the most substantial of stouts. I weathered the depressing era when Budweiser, Miller, and a couple of other nationalizers of bland beer drove a diversity of livelier regional brands out of business. But then I rejoiced in the last decade or so as a flowering of craft and microbrews has spread from city to city, creating an abundance of real gusto and local flavor from coast to coast. But beware, ye who love local beer, do not just sit on your duffs doing 12-ounce elbow bends, for here comes the big brew bastards again, bigger and more menacing than ever. In fact, they've gone global, wielding their predatory marketing clout and political muscle to rule beer world once and for all. SAB Miller, now a South African conglomerate, is trying to take over Heineken, the world's third-largest beer maker. But Anheuser-Busch, now owned by a Belgian-Brazilian monopolist called InBev, is trying to buy SAB Miller, creating a single beer behemoth that would control a third of all beer sales in the world. In our U.S. of A., the monopolization is worse, with InBev and SAB Miller effectively controlling three-fourths of our beer market. If InBev swallows SAB Miller, we're looking at higher prices, lower quality, and few choices. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, the red, white, and blue icon of American beer, Pabst Blue Ribbon, which dates back to 1844 and itself is a merged conglomerate that owns Colt 45, Old Milwaukee, and Schlitz, is being bought by a Russian brewer. Where is Teddy Roosevelt when we really need him?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO, is working on getting support for a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Yasser Abed Rabot, PLO's secretary, announced on Wednesday that according to the resolution, the complete withdrawal of the Israeli occupation that began in 1967 must occur before November 2016. Of the 15-member Security Council, seven countries are expected to vote in favor of the resolution. These are Russia, China, Jordan, Chad, Chile, Nigeria, and Argentina. The Palestinian leadership is looking to France and Luxembourg to approve it as well. Even if a majority of the council passes the resolution, it will likely be vetoed by the United States. Meanwhile, Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank attacked a number of nonviolent protests against the wall and the settlements. For more, we go to Iman Abed Rabot, a reporter for the International Middle East Media Center.
This week, Israeli forces conducted at least 37 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. During these invasions, Israeli troops kidnapped at least 27 Palestinians, including three children. On Thursday night, a Palestinian boy died of wounds he sustained during clashes with invading Israeli troops at the village of Beit Likya near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Baha Samir Badr, 13 years old, was playing football with his friends when Israeli soldiers invaded Beit Likya and opened fire at random at residents and their homes. A live round fired by Israeli soldiers hit Baha. Medical sources announced that Baha arrived at the Ramallah Medical Center after sustaining critical wounds and died shortly after. Also on Thursday, Palestinian Authority security forces killed a 25-year-old man during a raid in the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Security officials told local news that clashes broke out as PA forces attempted to arrest several wanted men who had been hiding south of Hebron in Area C. The wanted men reportedly opened fire at security forces during the raid, injuring 7 security personnel, including one who is now in critical condition. Earlier in the week, a young Palestinian man was shot and injured in his face during an Israeli military invasion on Tuesday at dawn into the Al-Far'a refugee camp near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Moreover, local sources said that soldiers detonated main doors of a number of homes before invading them and used several Palestinians as human shields while invading other homes in the refugee camp. In Jerusalem this week, Israeli forces continued to close Al-Aqsa Mosque for Palestinian worshippers and allow radical settler groups to storm the third holiest site for Muslims worldwide. During the clashes this week, around 20 Palestinian civilians were injured by Israeli gunfire and scores suffered effects of tear gas inhalation. For IMEMC News, this is Iman Abdrabbo Banoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, in the western province of Farah, 4 women were mysteriously killed late last night. The motive behind the killing remains unclear, but locals have suggested that they were suspected of adultery. The bodies of the 4 women were left on the side of the road in the central city of Farah. Honor killings are on the rise in Afghanistan, especially in the western provinces. Most are blamed by the government on armed militant groups. The Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission released a report in June that detailed over 240 cases of honor killing and 160 cases of rape around the country. But critics warn that this estimate is low, as many incidents are not reported.
In Nigeria, a deal between the government and Boko Haram might return missing schoolgirls to their families. In exchange for the promise of a ceasefire, the militant splinter group said they would return 200 girls that were kidnapped in April. Critics believe that the deal has been brokered so that the current president, Goodluck Jonathan, could position himself in a favorable light should he decide to run for re-election. Nigeria's chief of staff has ordered the military to stand down and comply with the ceasefire.
U.S. warships are remaining in the Philippines while investigators deal with the Marine suspected of killing a transgender Filipina. The Marine is still on the naval warship, where U.S. officials are preventing Filipino police from taking him to prison on murder charges. The group Center for Intercultural Organizing in Portland issued a statement calling for the justice in the case.
We at CIO would like to send our condolences to Jennifer's fiancé, family, and friends. There's a lot of factors that go into this case, but there are certain things that remain fact. And at the end of the day, someone did lose their life because they were brutally murdered. It is important that we call for justice for Jennifer and stand in solidarity with our trans brothers and sisters. This murder matters. It matters because in one story you have so much historical oppression coming into play. She's a trans woman, and that is important. She is a woman of color, and it is important to remind ourselves to respect her identity and call her by her name, Jennifer. She was murdered, and her murderer was someone who is considered a law enforcement agent, and that is important. And it is important that we talk about this case so that we start to change the dialogue and change the way society values some lives over others. We over at CIO believe in giving a voice to those who have been silenced. We demand that justice be served and that this case be taken seriously and that there is respect for Jennifer, her family, and the community around the world.
The murder of the transgender woman by a U.S. soldier in the Philippines has drawn attention to the continued militarization of the island nation. Protesters are calling for the withdrawal of U.S. forces, which have maintained a continuous military presence in the Philippines for over 100 years.
The controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership is being negotiated next week in Australia. President Obama says he's expected to finish negotiations and announce the agreement at a summit in China on November 11th. Indigenous groups, labor unions, and environmentalists have joined together in opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. The partnership, if passed, would be the largest trade agreement in history. TPP negotiators are scheduled to sit down again in Australia on October 19th through the 24th, with a ministerial-level meeting following on October 25th through the 27th. Drafts of the agreements leaked to the public by WikiLeaks show that the TPP would create an unprecedented level of corporate control over domestic laws. One impact will be increased difficulty to obtain life-saving cancer drugs in the countries impacted by the trade agreement. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Peter Mary Barduk of the watchdog group Public Citizens.
Peter, I understand you've been looking over the leaked documents, the latest leaks from WikiLeaks on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Can you tell us some of the most significant findings in these leaked documents?
Sure, and it's good to be with you. Well, unfortunately, the leaks to this free trade agreement, this essentially NAFTA with Asia, the latest leak out of WikiLeaks shows us that our government, the U.S. government, is pursuing measures on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry that would lead to preventable suffering and death in Asia-Pacific countries and also raise healthcare bills at home or undermine administration budget pledges to bring down costs, particularly new cancer drugs for Americans and for Medicare and Medicaid.
And how would it do that?
Well, for example, there's a particular provision, you find QQE20 in this 77-page text that talks about long automatic monopoly periods for biotech drugs. In the Affordable Care Act, we actually lost a big fight with bio and big pharma, in which they imposed on U.S. consumers 12-year automatic monopolies on biotech drugs, which includes most new cancer treatments. New cancer drugs today, they're priced over $100,000 per person, and it's very difficult for our health system to afford generally. Ever since that time, the Obama administration has pledged in its budgets to roll back that monopoly period to 7 years. Every year of monopoly means no affordable biosimilars, no competition. Competition is the thing that makes these drugs affordable. So there's an existing White House budget pledge to bring cost-saving competition onto the market sooner. They've undermined that in this secretive trade negotiation, telling other countries behind closed doors, actually, everyone in this room is going to impose long monopolies on cancer drugs and keep your cancer drug prices high, no matter what it does to your people. And if we sign that, that also means we won't be able to change the law in the United States. It's the White House going back on the public promise it's made to all of us. If we tried to change that rule, if we tried to lower cancer drug prices here at home, we'd be subject to lawsuits by the pharmaceutical companies through this trade agreement in these foreign trade tribunals under a system that's called investor state.
And I know one of the issues that have been brought up about the TPP is the fast-track authority by Congress that would allow President Obama to move ahead on signing this agreement. What's the status of that?
Well, Fast Track's in a lot of trouble. It faces tremendous opposition on both sides of the aisle in Congress. But you got it right. It's the mechanism by which Congress abdicates its constitutional authority over trade policy and gives it to the White House. It's a way for Congress to evade responsibility and for the White House to grab power and ram these bad trade agreements through on behalf of the corporation. So my understanding is the bill that was introduced last year has had a great deal of trouble, but we expect those folks to try again in the new year, and it's very, very important to beat Fast Track if we're to keep bad rules like this out.
And President Obama is pushing to get this through. He wants to be able to announce the agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership on November 11th when he meets for the APEC summit in China. What is the opposition doing, and is there a chance now of stopping the TPP at this point?
I think we have a very good chance of stopping the TPP. We just have to keep working at it. There have been several leaks that have shown people just how terrible the rules being discussed are and how much damage they would do to environment, to labor, to health, to financial regulation. And I think it's actually a pretty difficult agreement for the administration to conclude. Japan actually walked out of their last high-level discussions. And these rules here, there's tremendous pushback from developing countries, and those negotiators, you know, whom we know personally, been working with for several years, they deserve a lot of credit for their courage standing up to the most powerful country on earth and one of the most powerful industries. And that's part of what you see in this text, is in line after line, developing countries lining up to say no to the pharmaceutical industry and to the United States trade representative. So I think that opposition is something we really have going for us. It's helped reduce some of the damage that this agreement would otherwise do, and it may still beat the agreement. But those folks, they need the support of the American people, of course, commenting on this and indicating that we don't accept our government negotiating such terrible ideas in our name.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Mabarduke. He is with Public Citizen. Again, that website, citizen.org/TPP. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A new report found that wind power in Northern Europe has significantly reduced electricity prices. The Reuters report found that power prices in Finland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden have dropped sharply as renewable energy floods the market. Efficiency measures were also found to lower energy use overall. The study concluded that the wind power boom in these countries may make fossil fuel-fired power plants obsolete in the near future. This January, a coal plant in Finland closed its doors, and recently Norway decommissioned a gas-fired power plant as well.